I took 100% seriously the instruction that the talk should be not for the people in the program, and in fact should be appropriate for people in the other program, which happens to be molecular networks. And I assumed that people in the molecular networks program don't know anything about general relativity. So that set the framework for what this talk could be. So this is going to be a picturesque talk with heavy use of analogy and a little bit of instruction at the beginning about what general relativity is. And I could, given the count that David just did, try to make a quick change right now. But instead, I think I'll speak to the three people that are in the, okay, molecular networks program. And maybe other people will be entertained for their own reasons. So I also invite, once we get into a little bit of details down the road, experts in our program to pipe up if I say something less than accurate or informative about what I'm talking about. Okay, so just, I must begin with what is general relativity? And it's a theory of gravity formulated by Einstein in 1915. And it replaced Newtonian theory of gravity, which was basically the statement that any two masses attract each other with a force proportional to the distance, to the two masses, the product of the two masses, and inversely proportional to the square of the distance between them. And this was happening in space. The distance is measured in space. The force tells you how the things moved in time. And the space and the time were just fixed before the problem was set up. Newton referred to them as absolute, and he acknowledged that he had to do so to get his whole theory off the ground, to get the equations meaningful. Now, in Einstein's reformulation of gravity, gravity actually corresponds to curvature of space-time. So space and time in general relativity are unified together into one four-dimensional continuum whose metrical properties, that means lengths and times, are not fixed a priori, but are flexible, are deformable, and the deformations or curvature of them corresponds to the presence of gravity. And I want to actually attempt to explain to somebody who never heard of that idea or never understood it what it could possibly mean to say that gravity corresponds to curvature of space-time. So to begin with, I'll just say, remind you what curvature of space is. And that's the strategy through the whole talk, is to try to just appeal to things that are familiar and give you some sense of the unfamiliar. So I'll begin with one of the most common curved spaces, a sphere, the surface of a sphere like the surface of the Earth. And you can think of this as the Earth, and that's the equator. And one implication of the curvature is that if I mark off two points on the equator, there's some distance between them. And if I shoot off lines perpendicular to those, let's say they go up and meet at the North Pole. So these are both perpendicular. And then I measure the corresponding distance between those two lines up here, let's say here. That this length is shorter than that length. Despite the fact that I started with a line and sent off two perpendicular lines. So in a flat geometry, if I have a line and I send off two perpendiculars and then measure the perpendicular distance between them up here, of course, it'll be the same. I'll have a rectangle. So the change in this length is due to the curvature of the space. And exactly the same effect describes gravity in this room, except where this dimension around this way corresponds to time, and this dimension up this way corresponds to height. So if I take my watch and hold it here and hold another watch down here, I start them at the same time. I put one here and one here and wait for, let's say, 1 minute as measured by the watch up here. Then I bring them back together and compare them, and I'll find that the watch that was down here is actually behind. Less time elapsed down there than elapsed up here, even though they both stand in the same relation to, they're both static in this room, let me put it that way. So actually the gravity in the room corresponds to space-time curvature, that the flow of time is somehow slower down here than up here. And actually, it's interesting that even the extreme case has an analogy. If you go all the way up to the pole here, then you can get a situation where, whereas it's finite length here, there's no, this little short line shrinks down to zero length. So no length elapses up there. So you might ask, can I go down far enough, let's say, till I have no time elapsing? And I can't do that on the Earth, because once I get to the floor, then I start digging into the Earth, and then I go inside the matter that makes the gravitational field of the Earth, and I can go all the way to the center, and there'll be some minimum flow of time, but it won't go down to zero. However, if the material in the Earth were compacted into a small enough region, a black hole could form. A black hole is, it's a region where the gravitational field is so strong that light that is attempting to climb up away from it cannot escape. And the boundary between the region where light can escape and cannot escape is called the event horizon. And at the horizon, if I lowered my watch down to the event horizon of a black hole, it would be just like going up to this point on the sphere where no time would pass whatsoever. So that's an extreme case of this kind of space-time curvature. But just like the sphere is perfectly smooth at the North Pole, the space-time at the horizon of a black hole is also perfectly smooth. Although originally physicists were rather confused about what was happening there, but it's now understood that space-time is perfectly smooth at the horizon, despite the fact that no time is passing. That sounds at first very puzzling. How could no time pass anywhere? But remember, I said the horizon is a place where it's a dividing point between when light can escape and when light cannot escape from the black hole. So if I'm sitting right at the horizon, if my watch is sitting right at the horizon, it must actually be going upwards at the speed of light. So the evidently what we just figured out is that if something is moving at the speed of light, then no time passes at all along the space-time path of that thing. Okay, and that's actually natural, almost inevitable property in relativity, because if something's going faster than the speed of light, nothing can, by the way, in relativity, if you just consider a line in space-time that's moving sort of sideways faster than light could go, then in relativity it's understood to actually be moving in a spatial direction, not moving in time. It's space-like, not time-like. And then the length along that line would have to be actually a distance, not a time. So given that certain displacements in space-time are times and certain ones are distances, the dividing line between them we have to somehow match from both sides. The units change. I mean, it can't be, this is a distance, this is a time. The only consistent way for distances to turn into times is for them to go through zero. Okay, so something moving at the speed of light has no time and no distance in that sense. Okay, but still you may feel, if you've never heard this before, that I'm just telling you a bunch of things that don't really make any sense. You know, what does gravity have to do with the watch running slower down there? Gravity is the fact that if I throw the watch up, it'll come back down. That's gravity. So what does that have to do with this curvature? And well, the fact is that given that the space is curved, the notion of what it means to go straight in the space changes. So for instance, if you're going from here to here along the surface of the Earth, the plane never flies along this line of latitude, it will always take the shortest path, which will go up like that. That's why sometimes, you know, if you're flying in the northern hemisphere between very distant points, you go up over the pole, that's the shorter path. So similarly in space-time, the path between the initial and final position of my watch, if it goes up and comes down, that's some path in space and time, that path is the straightest path that my watch can follow. Now remember I said that time is running slower down here, so it's running faster up here. So compared to just sitting here, the path where my watch goes up and comes back down has more time elapsed on it. So that's a kind of opposite to what happens in space. The shortest path in a spatial situation is, the straightest path in a spatial situation is the shortest one. In this case, the straightest path happens to be the longest time. You might say, well, can I make the time longer by just having the watch shoot up, you know, really far and then coming back down really fast? The problem is to get back down at the same time, it has to go really fast. And soon it's going to get, at some point it will go at the speed of light, but we just inferred that at the speed of light no time will pass. So there's a competing effect that chooses some preferred path, and this one that it actually follows is precisely the one for which the total time elapsed is longest. So actually gravity is completely explained in this theory by a certain curvature of space-time. Okay, so how do you make a theory of that though? This is just a picture on the board, so you have to write equations to have physics. And the equations, I'll also start with this geometry. So we can write down in terms of the angles on the sphere theta and phi. So phi is measuring angle this way and theta is measuring angle this way. If we have a certain increment of angle theta and phi, how much length is does that correspond to? And it's given by this formula that the square of the length dl is the square of this angle plus the sine squared of that angle times d phi squared. Actually, that's if the sphere has a unit radius. If the sphere has some other radius, capital R, then I multiply the whole thing by R squared. So basically, this just comes from the Pythagorean theorem on the sphere. So what's telling us about the curvature of the sphere is really this function, this sine of theta. And you can imagine making a space with a different kind of curvature by replacing that with some other function, let's say g of theta, some arbitrary function. Then you'd make some other curved space. You could even set it equal to 1, and then you'd have a flat space, even though you used theta and phi as the coordinates. So this function captures the what's curved about the space. You can imagine doing the same thing in space-time. So to describe the effect of gravity in the room, let me use coordinates t for a time-like coordinate and h for the height above the floor. Then I could write a formula for the time, which is called in relativity by the letter s rather than t or tau, because it could be space, spatial or temporal, depending on the relation between the t and h increments. So we could write it, for instance, in this form. There's some function of the height times dt squared plus dh squared. So what this is supposed to tell you is that if you sit at a fixed time and just change the height, well, then the length between those two points is dh. And on the other hand, if we sit at a fixed height and let the time coordinate elapse, then the amount of time that passes is actually supposed to be, you take the negative. There's a minus sign here because time and length measurements are a completely different thing. And besides, we just figured out that it has to be able to be equal to 0 when you're going at the speed of light. When it's 0, it's when this term cancels this term. And when this term can be neglected, we're just sitting at a fixed height and time is elapsing, the amount of proper time, the amount of time the watch reads, is the square root of f times dt squared. So I'll just put that here. Clock time at fixed h is the square root of f of h times dt. So that's the way we get a mathematical description of this. Okay, well, here's a situation where the amount of time elapsed depended on where you were. We can also have in relativity a situation where the amount of space elapsed, so to speak, depends on when you are. And that's the situation, for example, with the expanding universe. At one cosmic time, the universe has some spatial geometry, and it's actually growing in time. So we can easily capture that by turning this around and making a function of time multiplying the spatial parts. So here's a classic way to describe that. So this is just the line element in a flat three-dimensional Euclidean space, and we multiply it by an overall number which depends on this t-coordinate. That's called the scale factor, and this just is measuring the time. If we fix x, y, and z, so these are all zero, then t just measures the time. So in an expanding universe, this function a of t is increasing in time. So you might picture that as something like this. So space is growing, time is going up this way, and x, y, and z are going this way. So in relativity, space-time becomes a deformable thing, and in fact, it can even be sort of fluid. For instance, if I shake my hand like this, then what the gravitational distortion that produces propagates away from my hand at the speed of light into space, and we have gravitational waves, which are described by a more complicated form like this, describing ripples in the curvature of space-time. Okay, so the picture is that space-time and general relativity is a kind of fluid, and just as a fluid has to satisfy some equation of motion that says how does it flow? If the pressure is greater here, the velocity changes, it accelerates, the density does this and that, we need an equation to describe the space-time fluid. That's called the Einstein equation. And it's a differential equation. It's actually a second order partial differential equation. It's nonlinear, very nonlinear. And it's not just an equation for one function, like, say, this fh here or this a of t. It's an equation for 10 different functions, because the most general distortion of space-time geometry we could write down would have 10 different functions. So, and the equations satisfied by all the functions are all coupled together. So it's nonlinear, and it's 10 coupled equations. So it's an extremely complicated set of differential equations. However, it is possible to summarize what they say physically in just words waving your hands, quite remarkably. And what they correspond to is the following statement. If you, let me explain it by just starting with this room again. Say I have a ball of particles here, of starting out with a spherically symmetric and at rest with respect to each other, and I drop them. So they'll all fall down. But if I look more closely, I'll notice that they don't actually just all fall straight down. The ones on this side of the ball fall a little bit inwards towards the center of the Earth that way. And the ones on this side fall a little bit inwards this way, and so forth. So from the side, the ball actually shrinks a little bit. Since as it gets down to the center of the Earth, it would actually come down to a point. On the other hand, the ones on the top of the ball feel a slightly weaker gravitational force than the ones on the bottom, so the distance between the top and the bottom of the ball stretches out a little bit. So the ball actually distorts initially. If I start it at rest, the first thing it'll do is distort into an ellipsoid, stretched out this way and scrunched this way. The volume of that distorted ball will be initially, although distorted, it will be the same volume as it started out with. If I make a kind of expansion, an approximation, the initial distortion will preserve the volume. And it turns out that that is precisely the statement of Einstein's field equation for the curvature of space-time. As long as that property holds, no matter what point I start at, and no matter what initial velocity I start at, if that's true, then Einstein's equation holds. That's in vacuum. If we have a source of gravity, like matter, if our ball of imaginary particles is inside the Earth, then the volume will change. In fact, it will get smaller in a way that's proportional to the density of energy and the pressure inside the ball. So that's roughly what that equation says. Well, that's the introduction to general relativity. So if you didn't get it, you'll be lost for the rest of the talk. Okay. Now, so Einstein basically let the genie out of the bottle by doing this. Because once that space-time can distort, and he writes down this differential equation, the equation takes over, and strange things can happen. So the kind of strange thing that can happen is that the curvature of space-time can become infinite as a consequence of the equation, and at that point, the equation itself becomes meaningless. An example would be with the expanding universe. If we trace this backwards in time, say to a point, it turns out that this represents a time and place where the curvature of space-time was infinite. In fact, the size of space itself could have shrunk to zero if we imagine that space itself is finite, for instance, by identifying this side with this side and this side with this side. And it's like we have a donut that shrinks down to zero size, and the curvature is infinite there. So if we ask in general relativity, what happened before that, there's no answer. Because the equation says, infinity, doesn't tell you what happens next. That's called a space-time singularity. It's a place where, an example of a singularity is a place where the curvature becomes infinite and the equation breaks down. Another example of such a singularity is inside a black hole, and I want to explain what that kind of singularity is, because it's one of the ones we're most fascinated by. And of course, I'll tell you why we care about this later, but I first want to tell you what a singularity is. So let's make a black hole by collapsing some matter into a small region. So to draw a picture of that, I want to have time going up this way and space going this way. And my matter could be, for instance, a shell, and the shell will implode, and I can draw that this way on the board. So this is supposed to be an imploding shell. And inside the shell, there's no gravity. And outside the shell, there's the gravitational field of whatever mass is in the shell. So if we imagine light propagating in time and in space inside, it will go out like this, like it always does, in a cone. But then the gravity of this shell can stop it so that it just doesn't escape, it doesn't go in, and it doesn't go out. There's a critical radius at which that happens, and that's the event horizon. This is the horizon. So this is supposed to be an actual light ray in space-time that it's neither escaping far away nor falling in. Anything slightly outside of it would escape away like that. And light, a light ray that's trying to go out inside will actually fall inwards. What will it fall into? What's inside here? Well, at the point where the shell collapsed to zero size, a region of infinite curvature arose, which is another form of singularity. This is And this singularity is something that you can't avoid meeting if you find yourself inside the event horizon. And the reason is that, let's say we draw a light ray that falls in. So out here, the cone of light that could leave this point might look like that. Here it might look like this. The horizon itself is a light ray. So the cone of light sitting on the horizon looks like this. And if I go yet further in, the cone squeezes down like that. So you can see now that if you happen to find yourself at this point, and you really don't want to fall into the singularity, that's too bad, because even if you go at the speed of light, you'll still only be following this path and you'll hit the singularity. Which really means that the singularity is to the future of all possible, of all points inside the horizon. There's no way to escape it. In fact, so that means it looks something like this. We could picture it like, here's the singularity. And here's a light cone. And any path to the future from this point must be going somehow at or less than the speed of light. And all of those paths hit this singularity. The singularity is really like a surface in space. So that's why it's called space-like. So I'll call this a space-like. And so you see that the actually both the singularity in the case of an expanding universe, the so-called Big Bang singularity, and the one inside a black hole like this are space-like singularities. And there are places where the equations, you know, you try to turn the crank and the equations get stuck. So there's infinite curvature. Now remember I said that gravity corresponds to squeezing in some directions and stretching in other directions. Like on a merry-go-round. So if you fall into this black hole, what happens is in the sideways directions you have a squeezing that becomes infinite as you approach the singularity, and there's a stretching in the longitudinal direction that becomes infinite. And in fact, that infinite stretch is really totally baffling, because if I draw a line, say, here on the diagram, that's some space-like line, because the light cones are tipped in sideways like this. And as this line approaches the singularity, the length of that line becomes infinite. Even though it looks on my diagram like it's got a fixed size, there's a function in the metric, like this thing, telling you that the length of this line becomes infinite. And even if we stop where the theory we believe breaks down, we still get an unbelievable amount of stretching. This is a point that I'm not even sure that all people in the field are, you know, pungently aware of. If I send these two light rays in separated by 1 second as measured out here, and I measure the distance between these, the length of this line, when the curvature becomes equal to the maximal curvature at which we trust the theory, the so-called Planck curvature, then this length is 1 million light years, if the mass of the black hole has the mass of a typical star. So it's a stretching of 1 second time into 1 million light years length. And it doesn't take 1 million years for that to happen. It takes a microsecond, in the sense of the time experienced by an observer that falls into the hole. So this singularity represents an extreme distortion of the space-time structure. And we want to understand that. Why do we want to understand it? Well, first of all, it's unavoidable. I won't go into this much, but you might think this is a special situation. It turns out this sort of thing is a generic property of the Einstein equations, that under certain qualitative circumstances, this will happen. So it's not an exception, it's the rule. So we should face it. Now, why should we face it? Could we ever observe it? So the first thing is, physics is supposed to be the study of things you can observe about the physical world. Well, how about a Big Bang-like singularity like that? If we live in the cosmos up here, we can actually see into the past, because if we look out in space around us, we see light, for instance, that came to us from far away. And light takes a certain time to propagate. So when it originated, that was a time that was earlier. So you might think if we could just look far enough away, we could see far enough back in time to actually see what was happening here. Well, we can't actually see it in terms of light, because on the way, the light gets absorbed by a plasma of ionized, protons and electrons. So any light we see actually will have been, there won't be any image of the singularity. We'll just see this plasma. But there are things that don't interact with the plasma, like, say, neutrinos or gravitational waves. And they might have come from some earlier epoch. And we might hope to actually see them. But what would we see? We wouldn't see an image like some early TV show or something. What we might see, though, is something about the statistical pattern of fluctuations or inhomogeneities, bumpiness of space-time, the conditions that existed here that produced what we do see at a later time. So there is some chance of seeing the effect of the physics at the singularity that goes beyond what we know. Another possibility you might ask is, could we see this kind of singularity? Suppose you're brave enough to jump into a black hole and say, I really want to see it. You jump in, and then you will run into it, as I explained, but you won't see it. Because the moment you hit it will be the end of your life, because it looks like this. So you jump in and you hit it, it's to your future. The moment that you hit it. It's never something over there that you can look at, like that chair. But that's a special situation, which I created by sending in this imploding shell, and it was all very symmetrical, and the singularity was hidden behind this horizon. Could you do it in somehow a more chaotic way and produce a singularity that you could see? Well, for example, let's say you have a star that's spinning around rapidly, say a neutron star, and then it implodes, or some bigger star, some kind of star. It implodes and becomes dense and makes a black hole and a big explosion and stuff comes off. Is it possible that because of asymmetries in this, you might actually see the singularity? Or another situation you might have is two stars orbiting around each other, spiraling in, and they crash into each other and form a black hole, but it's a very distorted black hole, certainly not spherically symmetric. Could we see the singularity before it got hidden behind an event horizon? Well, most likely the answer is no. There's a conjecture that the answer is no, called cosmic censorship. And basically it says that any newly formed singularity will always be hidden behind an event horizon. And there's a lot of evidence that it's true, except in very artificial situations that wouldn't be generic. So we're not motivated by the idea that somehow in telescopes we're going to see a naked singularity. They're called naked if they're not hidden behind an event horizon. It's not that, really. What we're motivated by is that the breakdown of the theory at the singularity is the place where the new theory, whatever it is, takes over. And what we're interested in is what replaces general relativity at the singularity. Once we could figure that out, if we ever do, it's quite plausible it would have implications not just at singularities, but in general in physics. It's the theory that replaces general relativity. Here's an analogy for it. In the history of physics, consider an atom. So we have a nucleus with positive charge and electrons going around the nucleus. And if we just follow the electrical attraction of the electron in the nucleus, the electron will radiate electromagnetic waves and spiral in and crash into the nucleus. And that's a disaster, first of all, because matter would not be stable, so it doesn't agree with what we observe. But from the point of view of just the theory, once the electron falls into this center in the nucleus, we don't know what happens. The theory is incomplete. So you could regard that as kind of analogous to what's happening here. So what possible completions of this theory could there be? Well, one kind would be that you have some theory that tells you what happens once an electron falls into a nucleus, which means that you kind of blow up the nucleus into a structure that you understand, like, say, that has protons and neutrons in it. And then there's a theory of electron capture, where an electron can go into a proton, and by a completely different interaction, not electromagnetic interaction, can convert the proton to a neutron and emit a neutrino. It's just a completely different kind of physics that could take over inside there. And so that's one possibility. But in fact, what really happens, and this actually can happen in a sufficiently heavy nucleus or atom, but what happens in other atoms is simply that the picture changes radically, as I'm sure you all know. You just get a wave function of the electron. It's not actually a point going around. And the reason it doesn't fall into the nucleus is because of quantum mechanics. In particular, the uncertainty principle. So if the electron were to fall into the nucleus, it would be localized in a smaller and smaller region. But according to the uncertainty principle, if something is localized in a very small region of space, it must have a very uncertain momentum, and therefore uncertain energy. So in fact, it would take a lot of energy for the electron to get into this small region, so it won't happen. So it just stays spread out at some size. And that's another way that the singularity could be resolved. In this case, the singularity, so to speak, happens, and the theory of what happens is something beyond electrodynamics into the weak interactions and the structure of a nucleus. In this case, it's really nothing beyond electrodynamics, but it's just applying quantum mechanics to electrodynamics and sort of avoiding the singularity. So we could call this singularity avoidance. And this something like singularity resolution, or I picked some word for it. Well, maybe it doesn't matter. Resolution. Okay, so coming back to the situation we're interested in, what could happen, for example, at this singularity here? We've got space crushed infinitely this way and stretched infinitely that way. And it seems to be it's a space-like singularity, so what happens next on the other side of it is the question. So this is one of the subjects that we discuss in this mini program. We don't know. One idea is that there's nothing on the other side. So this is somehow a ragged edge to space-time, as if you just take the piece of paper and tear it, and that's just the edge. Another possibility is that you go through into another region where there's another either region of space-time or something new. So given our ignorance about what happens, I'm going to go back to, at this stage, I want to go back to the analogy with the fluid and say, what kind of singularities happen in fluid flow and how do they get resolved? What are the different ways that it could happen? Actually, I'll just take two examples. So one example, so let's say singularities in fluid flow. So one would be droplet formation. So we can have a faucet with a stream of water coming out, and some instability in the transverse oscillations of it, it's stretched out longer, it can pinch off like this and form a droplet that breaks off. Certainly, up to just before the point of the droplet breaking off, the equations of hydrodynamics describe this. The equations tell you it will get narrower and narrower, and the equations tell you it will get to a point where the equations don't tell you what happens. So at that point, it could be something like this, which is fairly simple. What you don't know, what's not described by the hydrodynamic equation is some very small region in space and time where there's just a little bit of a glitch. You can jump over it. After the drop breaks loose, even this singular point will heal itself and it will just become a spherical droplet described once again perfectly by fluid mechanics. But strictly speaking, to describe this process, you need to understand at some level the atomic structure of the water, but only in a minimal way. And it's possible to jump across that and just say, I don't know how it happened, but somehow it happened. Okay, so that's one paradigm for how a certain kind of singularity in fluid flow could be resolved. By the way, this is there's a kind of nice image relating this picture to what might happen at the black hole singularity. It could be that what's happening is a piece of the space-time fluid is sort of pinched off on the inside, and you have another disconnected piece of the universe on the inside. It's once again described by the Einstein equation, but we don't know. Another example I want to mention that's qualitatively extremely different is cavitation. So in this situation, we could have a fluid flowing in a tube that's narrowing. And because of the Bernoulli principle, as the velocity, I have a certain amount of mass coming through, it has to get through a narrower neck, so it's going faster here. Because of the extra speed, the pressure drops according to the Bernoulli effect. And at some point here, the pressure can get low enough that it's below the vapor pressure of this fluid. And what would happen is a bubble would form. Pressure drops below vapor pressure. In fact, if we didn't know about vapor pressure and we just solved the hydrodynamic equation, we'd get negative pressure at some point would arise and we'd go, whoa, you know, we need a new theory. What happens? This equation doesn't apply with negative pressure. But what happens refers to formation of a bubble, and what's inside the bubble is vapor, which really consists of discrete atoms of whatever the fluid was made of. So this we could, this is a form of phase transition. where what would be a singularity, if you allow me to call it that, in the fluid equations of negative pressure is resolved by the fact that a new phase of the fluid is created in a bubble. And then whatever, it can go on from there. So this turns out to be a very nice analogy for something I'll mention a little bit later in space-time. In either case, the microscopic theory of the fluid is what we need to understand it fundamentally, and that's what we're after in the case of space-time. What is the microscopic theory of space-time structure? And just like here, quantum physics came in and played a crucial role in resolving the singularity, we expect it's the quantum theory of space-time structure that we need to understand. So this is a subject in quantum gravity theory. All right. What time is it? Uh-oh. All right, let's see. Maybe I should skip something. Yeah. No, I can't. Okay, so I'll just condense. So basically, I just have three more parts to this Blackboard talk. I've introduced the problem, told you what general relativity is. Now I'd like to say a few things about what we've been hearing about in the program about singularities. One is the classical approach to the singularity. Another is an approach that involves quantum general relativity resolution of singularities, and the other one is string theory, which includes general relativity, and then can address the question of singularities in terms of this framework, which includes general relativity. Here I'll just mention the following thing. What I mean is, for instance, like in this picture, as we approach the breakoff of the drop, until the very end, it's described by the fluid equations. Similarly, we could ask, how is the approach to this singularity here described by the Einstein equation? In a perfectly symmetrical situation, it's very easy to say exactly, but in the generic situation, it turns out to be very complicated, but not so complicated. So there's a conjecture about a simplification in the structure of the singularity that was made 35 years ago, which has been recently confirmed by computer studies of time evolution of the classical Einstein equation approaching such a singularity. And the answer is basically that the spatial gradients in the field equation become not important. As the singularities approached asymptotically, the dominant effect is the time derivatives, not the space derivatives. And in fact, it becomes sort of, the space derivatives become completely negligible as the singularity is hit. So this is a great simplification, classically. Now, quantum mechanically, we believe as we're flying into the singularity, at some point we'll transcend the validity of the classical equation. But what this result tells us is that when we get there, it may well be that the time derivatives are dominating and we can neglect the space derivatives. And this raised the question that people would like to study. I don't think there's too much on it yet. Is could the same thing be true in the quantum theory? That even though the most general singularity you could imagine is horrifyingly complicated, the actual structure is dramatically simpler because the spatial derivatives can be neglected. If so, each point sort of evolves separately. And that could be quite, you know, useful in guiding us to understanding what the structure of the singularity is in the quantum theory. Then that brings us right to quantum general relativity. So things will get rather vague now for the rest of the talk, but. So there are difficulties of quantum general relativity. Remember here I said we just ended up applying quantum mechanics to classical electrodynamics and solved the problem. Can we just do the same thing with general relativity? Well, the difficulties are enormous. There are technical difficulties. Not just that we don't have a big enough computer, but even that the equations we try to write down are meaningless because they're infinities, so-called divergences. In fact, in any quantum field theory, there are divergences, but in the case of quantum general relativity, they're more problematic than in other quantum field theories. And then there's a deep conceptual problem in this theory, which is that, remember that general relativity is a theory of space and time, and the amount of time elapsed depends on the metric. If we now apply quantum mechanics to this theory, the amount of time that passes becomes a quantum mechanical, subject to quantum fluctuations and uncertainty. But this means that the notion, there is no classical time. And so what do we even mean at that point then by saying that we have a singularity that's lying to our future and we're worried about falling into it in a certain time when we don't even know what time is, depending on the quantum state? So this is a very deep problem which has simple-minded solutions in order to allow us to do something. But at the deepest level, I think it's fair to say that it is totally unresolved aspect of the theory. So the meaning of evolution is not a priori clear. So now I'll describe the most prominent approach today towards just trying to quantize general relativity by itself. It's called loop quantum gravity. Of course, I won't tell you hardly anything about it, but just a couple of essentials. So classically, we can take space-time, where this is space and this is time, and we can slice it up into layers of space at different moments of time. And if we pull one of those layers out of this deck of cards, then we have space at one time. Now, to get off the ground, this loop quantum gravity approach does just this. For reasons I can't really explain now. But having done so, it has the burden of somehow reconstructing space-time after having pulled out space. This is not a hopeless idea because actually at the classical level it's understood how to pull time out of just picture of space. But we need to understand it at the quantum level also ultimately. And like I said, we have provisional ways of dealing with that by basically introducing physical clocks into the description. So what happens in this loop quantum gravity is that the continuous geometry is replaced by a discrete structure, just like a continuous fluid is replaced by atoms in an atomic theory of matter. And the discrete structure we could think of as a graph. And somehow the edges of the graph are labeled by integers. And the information in the connectedness of this graph and these integers gives us some notion of discrete geometry. And translating continuous geometry into this language, we find that curvature cannot be infinite, but it's bounded. I think the analogy is perfectly good with the droplet like this, where you can imagine a classical fluid flow that had a singular spike in the shape of the fluid. It's infinitely curved at the tip, but that can't happen here. So within this theory, people have been studying the description, I think I erased it, of the Big Bang type singularity, replacing space by a structure like this, and finding that due to the curvature boundedness, the singularity is avoided by a bounce. Bounce at the Big Bang. It's a generic result in this construction that curvature by its very essence cannot become infinite, and in particular applying it to the dynamics of the Big Bang singularity, assuming a lot of symmetry, one finds a bounce. Assuming less symmetry, there are a little bit less symmetry, there are arguments that there will also be a bounce, and even no symmetry, the curvature is still bounded. So there's some kind of resolution of infinite curvatures in this theory. This is all in the framework which still has deep conceptual problems, and we're not sure we can reconstruct space-time from space, but it's an approach to understanding the structure of a singularity.
Does it say anything about cosmic censorship surviving?
No. I mean, just because it's not developed to the point where it could address such a question. In fact, but I would say that cosmic censorship is probably more a classical question. That is, if we, you could formulate cosmic censorship as the question, will curvatures equal to the Planck curvature ever arise that are visible from regular initial data in the classical theory? If they do, then of course what you see might depend on the quantum theory. But whether or not that big a curvature could arise is a classical question.
Another simple way to put it is that cosmic censorship is the question of whether astrophysicists have to worry about quantum gravity, right? If all quantum gravity affects
well,
the side by poles, then they don't.
I was asking
if they do
reason,
that.
How do you know?
I took it in the.
Analogies are interesting, except you know one can actually get data on it. So my real question is. If you relax, if somehow one of these violates cosmic censorship, I mean, so the question is, where's the burden? Is the burden that you don't have to violate, is cosmic censorship viewed as something you had better not violate in any of these formulations, or is it up for grabs?
Oh, no, it would be fine if it were violated. It would not only be fine, it would be wonderful. Then we could actually have a chance of seeing some of this and
but it's a question
checking the theory.
Classical theory. In the classical theory, you can ask that question. The only sort of effective ways that we have to address that question in the classical theory is they apply computer simulations, and the computer simulations indicate that it's not violated.
But in loop quantum gravity, lots of things are violated. You have to recover. For example, resonance. At the same scale. So if you want to test it, just test for Bunsen-Brand violation of Planck energy.
Yeah, I don't think that's what the question was getting at. I have one page left, which is not without merit, so let me try to just go over it and finish a little bit late. Like I said, this would be a very picturesque talk. Not much concrete. But there are a couple of nice pictures in this part. So what about string theory approach? So the conceptual idea of string theory is that general relativity is really just a part of a bigger theory. And so how does that help? Well, in terms of these difficulties, certain of the difficulties, of technical difficulties we have in quantum general relativity are ameliorated in string theory. So there are more certain situations that are more manageable. One might just say, to be democratic, there are different situations that are manageable in the two theories. But in particular, with regard to this problem of recovering space-time from space, string theory does less damage ab initio to the space-time structure than loop quantum gravity is, so it doesn't have the burden of recovering the space-time picture. It has other burdens. As far as this point goes, I just want to make a remark. I believe that string theory has the conceptual difficulties of quantum general relativity absolutely equally much as loop quantum gravity does, but they just happen to be not the things that string theorists tend to focus on. So, but that's not to say that they're not there. And I can actually confirm this by, I sat there and watched on my computer screen a panel discussion at a strings meeting in Toronto where the string theorists got themselves into discussing these difficulties and recognizing that they were really at the root of the deepest questions in string theory. So I just want to make it clear to people that don't know anything about this that this is a very important aspect of quantum gravity that we're nowhere near resolving. So, but what do we do then in string theory? There's a general strategy in string theory, which is to identify situations where one has enough technical control to actually do something correct, that you believe with confidence is correct. And those situations may not actually describe the physical world that we live in. So it's a different philosophy. Generally, people doing this approach try to say, we take gravity in four dimensions, quantize it, and this is our world. String theorists say, that's too hard a problem, but in string theory, I can identify this other world, like the bizarro world in Superman comics, or you know, where you know I can go into that corner and say, now I have complete control, and I'll tell you what happens here, and I hope that by learning about that, I can export that knowledge and learn about the world we actually live in. I mean, certainly in principle, string theory, the idea is that a sector of, or a solution of, or something, formulation of string theory will describe our world, but that's really not the way that the research program works. So we identify situations that where we have control. And I want to mention two of them that we've heard about in the program that are interesting. Tachyon condensation. And that's the first one I'll just mention. So this corresponds to a pinching off of space, analogous to that droplet. So a situation can be set up where one dimension of space is closed on a circle like this, and such that when that circle size wants to shrink like this, so it's a smaller circumference, and when it reaches some critical narrowness of this neck, it actually closes off like that and becomes actually a disconnection in the space. Now, the way this is actually studied in the theory is that when this radius becomes small, there's a kind of instability, and all the particles that are trying to propagate in here get reflected away from there. It's kind of a no-entry zone. And in the limit of small pinching, there's an infinite exclusionary force pushing everything away, so in effect there's nothing there because there's just no way to get from here to here. Now what actually happens in there is not known because there's a separate description of this part. So the analog over here would be this cavitation of this bubble. The pressure gets negative, the bubble appears, the space that was inside there and the fluid is gone. What's inside it is vapor, but we don't know the description of the vapor in the string theory, but we do have the fluid around the bubble. In fact, the analogy with the bubble is extremely good, and you can see it. It's worth drawing this just for fun. This is one dimension and another one around, and I'm pinching off at one point in this dimension. But suppose instead I had a slab like this, And let's say the dimension that the thing that's identified is the top and bottom of the slab. So just like here, I identify the top and bottom by having a circle that goes around. If I go out the top, I come in the bottom here. And then if I press on the top and the bottom and make a dimple like this, if these think, then the cycle is shorter around that way. And if I push it close enough, it can actually make a transition to being connected. And so then I actually have a tube that connects, that punches through this slab. And it looks like, well, maybe I have to draw it again. Oops. Sort of like, I hope you get the idea that you can go from this side through the tube to the other side. So there's just some empty, missing part of the slab there. And it turns out in string theory that you can sort of approach this from both sides. There actually is a description of the space that's got the dimples, and there's a description of the space with the hole in it. And this picture that the space inside is disappearing is verified in a sense by jumping across. This is exactly what I was trying to get at with this droplet here, or something like this, that there's a jump that we don't understand, but we can describe either side of it. Here we see the topology of space changing. So that's one situation that's been described. And I could stop, or I could describe another extremely interesting one. Okay. I'll take 5 minutes. So the last example I wanted to give was a very different approach to understanding space-time singularities in string theory. It's through what's called gauge gravity duality, or also known as the ADS-CFT duality, due to Maldacena in 1997, initially introduced. So the key idea here is that the way to understand gravitational singularities is to get rid of gravity. Actually, the motive is not to understand singularities, it's to understand all of string theory, but in particular, it would understand singularities. So the picture is that we have space-time in here, and at the boundary of space-time, and inside the space-time, we have string theory, which includes gravity. So string theory and gravity. And on the boundary, so to speak, we have a separate theory that's equivalent to this, which is called the CFT, conformal field theory. The key point, if you're just trying to follow this schematically, is that this has no gravity. So according to this conjecture, for which there's a lot of evidence, a theory with strings and gravity is completely equivalent to a theory with no gravity. If you don't have gravity, then you're like back to Newtonian physics. Space-time is fixed, singularities cannot arise, everything is completely understood, the question goes away. Well, the question becomes the following: how does what appears as a singularity in space-time become described in this conformal field theory, which has no gravity? And this is something that's been able to be studied a little bit, and as ongoing studies are looking at how to describe such a singularity. And I think I did have something to say more about it specifically, but I think I should stop, having run over 15 minutes. Thank you.
Well, that was a great talk. So all of the people in the program learned how to do that.
Maybe.
Are there any questions from the
model? If I understood what you said about the cognitive censorship, if there's any that singularity would be screened from observation by an event horizon.
Yeah.
Curvature is bounded as is in many of the loop quantum gravity, then there are no singularities.
Right.
So what does it mean?
It would mean that you'd, any region where a very, very high curvature that could show this structure would be screened. I mean, that's what I would mean by it.
In the case of the loop gravity of bounds, bounds of the singularity,
yes.
Is that only for the resolution of a big crunch where you're coming back in, or is it also resolution of t equals zero in the singular outgoing case?
It's also, yeah, it's both. In fact, solutions have been obtained that just show a repeated series of expansions and bounces and expansions and bounces.
So what happens in the case where you don't have the recollapse in geometry, but you only have it's just a single shot?
I think that the expert's telling me, I think there's just one bounce. So it comes in, bounces, and goes out, and that's it. Yeah. You mean is there?
It's like a quantum evolution. Like, and you start with the universe now, for example, you walk back in time towards a big bang. And you want to know do the equations break down or do they predict something? In the simplest models, they do predict something. The quantum evolution does not break down. You get something on the other side, and then you look at it. And it turns out that, in fact, does correspond to the universe which is contracting until you come to the Planck regime. Then, of course, you don't have the quantum evolution.
That's one second. That's in the most symmetrical model.
Yeah.
Whether the full theory would predict that or something more complicated going backwards in time is not known. Or it could just unravel into quantum geometry.
Yeah. I just wanted to just one quick thing about quantum gravity. I mean, I think the classical motivation for quantum gravity was really that at the singularity, predictability breaks down. If the singularities were not hidden at the horizon, then we could not do physics in a predictive way outside. That was the motivation right there. Now, of course, you can rephrase it by saying, well, are these Planck scale effects visible from outside?
Right.
That's it. Of course, the interesting thing to look at.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a very different thing now, because it's not in the same spirit as possible. So it's not because something broke down. Everything is really different. Can you see it or can you not see it? It's an interesting issue. But it's not like there was a problem for which a new principle or new conjecture has to be reported.
Yeah, I completely agree. But still, the classical study of the cosmic censorship and its validity is relevant to the question of whether we'll ever be able to see directly such regions where the curvature is Planckian. Yeah.
That's a little bit of a red herring, because in the full quantum theory, right, if we ever saw an evaporating primordial black hole, for example, that would be a case where we saw a region with Planckian curvature.
Yeah, right. And clearly the most, I have in mind astrophysical ones, like, you know, coalescing neutron star binary that forms a very asymmetric object. Because that's happening all the time. We don't have to wait to find a primordial black hole. But I agree.
Yeah, I thought I talked recently making an analogy between this horizon and a critical point in phase transition.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, I don't think that's actually a good analogy. This thing is more like a critical point, maybe, where just all quasiparticles are repelled from that region, nothing can cross it, and there's a phase change there. Horizon is very different. At a point on the horizon, space-time looks precisely the same as it does anywhere else. I think it's not a good analogy.
Except in critical gravitational collapse, where there are other analogies.
Oh. Okay. That's a finely tuned situation.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask a question about epistemology, which is a word I only use about once a decade.
Well, we're privileged to hear it this decade.
So I'm picturing like a little submarine swimming against the current in your water coming out of the faucet. And from an observer in that submarine, you know, could he ever really ever figure out what happened to the water? You know, I mean, he could hypothesize that there was a singularity and that there was a drop beyond the singularity, but he might not ever be able to tell. So what I'm asking is, do you have any reason to expect that we should be able to answer a question, what is on the other side of the singularity, or is this just philosophy?
I definitely expect, since it's simply a continuation of the physical theory we have, which is very well verified, and a breakdown of the theory we have, that there must be a physical theory that can handle it. But part of your question was, do I hope to ever see what actually happened at the bubble, so to speak, or at the singularity?
Or to have evidence of what's behind
right.
it, rather than just...
You're talking about, like, observational evidence.
Well, eventually you'd like not just have a theory that incorporates what's behind it, but you'd like to have what used to be called proof.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know if you may... We're not here at the beginning of my talk, but I did... state what my attitude about that was, which is that the one singularity that we may actually see some effects of is the Big Bang singularity, since that is actually in our past and things emerged from it that we see today. But on the whole, I think that the more it looks like we don't have a way of directly probing singularities such as those inside black holes. However, if we had a theory that could handle that, it presumably would have other predictions about things that we can observe. But I have to say that I share your misgivings about, you know, focusing on a problem that we at this stage have no direct observational access to.
Okay, before we get bogged down in singularities,
Thank you.
I missed a lot of it, but I could see a good amount.